Welcome to episode 74 of the Vancouver Tech Podcast. I have a couple of amazing guests with us here today, Dave Uberti and Nikolai Malyarov of PressReader. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Dave, let's start with you a little bit because you're a guest from out of town today. You're in Vancouver, hopefully enjoying some nice weather. And hopefully it'll rain for you, because you need to remember Vancouver for Vancouver.
I want something to remember the city by, and to this point, it really has been, you know, lackluster, so I need a good downpour before
Absolutely.
I go back.
I mean, I could imagine going to Hawaii and not going to the beach.
Right.
You know, like, that would be like going to Vancouver and not seeing rain, in my opinion. It's one of the best things, greatest features. So how long are you in town for?
Just until tomorrow, really. I was just in town for a great event with PressReader. I'm a staff writer for a magazine called the Columbia Journalism Review in New York, where we do a mixture of media reporting and media criticism. So we were talking through with a lot of people outside of the industry at a breakout event this morning just about how to approach some of the really existential problems within media and technology today.
Very cool. So there's quite a few things we'd like to drill down with you about regarding that. But before we do, Nikolai, thank you very much for being back on. Tell us a little bit about PressReader, about your role there, and about what this event was all about.
Well, PressReader, apart from being a miniature version of the United Nations by virtue of the culture that we've built in the company, we tend to wear multiple hats. We're going in so many different directions that I have two primary hats. One is I oversee the content side of the company in terms of building relationships with publishers and how we transform those relationships into simply beyond distribution of that content. And the other side is the legal side. So I'm a general counsel for the company. But PressReader is an amazing company, and I've been with it for 14 years now.
Very cool. A lot of very interesting changes in technology, in print media, and digital media, I'm sure, in the last 14 years. So what was this event that was going on that brings people from all the way from New York City?
Well, TED itself obviously requires no introduction. Vancouver is, I think, in a privileged position. Obviously because of all the rain that we get, because it's such a great feature of the city, to host such an event. And this is the first time that at the main TED event, the organizers decided to hold workshops. So they're being held in between the sessions that are televised and, you know, being broadcast, around the world. So we were invited to host one of the workshops, and it was about breaking the news and what's next. And we decided to style it in a hackathon or miniature hackathon, way, which was incredibly difficult considering the time constraints that we had. We had an hour and a half for the whole session, which means that you don't know the audience that's coming. They're all pre-registered for it. They show up. You know, you have zero understanding as to what is their level of expertise in the publishing industry. So you have to start from scratch. You have to do a lay of the land as to where the publishing industry today. Naturally, there are certain interests that these people would have in terms of content distribution, you know, trust in content that we have, in content that they consume, and the new models that are evolving out of the changes that are being brought into the industry. So this mini hackathon was to get the people talking about the solutions for the challenges that the industry is experiencing. And we invited three experts from the field, kind of split between the three challenges that we posed to the audience. And David was one of the experts that we'd invited, that would help facilitate, the conversation in these mini groups that we had at this hackathon and help answer some questions, perhaps field some ideas that were perhaps less novel, have been explored, but lack sort of longevity, because we're looking for viability of a solution, the creativity of a solution, and the timeliness. You know, we're not looking for a pie in the sky, but something that can be implemented fairly quickly.
Very cool. Okay, David, let's hop back to you. Tell us a little bit about Columbia Journalism Review, what that is, what your part is as a staff writer.
Sure, sure. We are a magazine, and by magazine, I mean we're a website, print product. I host a podcast called The Kicker. I write a weekly newsletter for our members and our community. And basically, it's a mixture of media reporting and media criticism. So we analyze news coverage and the narratives that emanate from news coverage, but also cover some of the trends that are driving financial change or economic change within the industry. So that could be anything from consumption habits to sort of the advertising side of things. So one of the things that's changed for us, particularly over the last year since the U.S. presidential election, is there's been very much renewed public interest in sort of the social good that is journalism, what journalism should be and what role it plays within society. So not only now are we trying to hold media institutions accountable, but also act as a sort of ambassador for journalism, what journalism should be, and communicate that message to a larger public outside of the media industry.
So I'm not sure if this is a side effect, but a very interesting thing about Trump's election and the process, I think, is that it seems to have gotten a lot more people interested in and talking about politics. Have you found that to be true? And what sort of challenges has this brought up within the media industry?
I mean, he's certainly the most polarizing subject of journalism that I've ever come across. People either are diehard Trump fans or they're, you know, diehard anti-Trump fanatics. So I think it presents some challenges for journalists. We sort of adhere to this ideal of objectivity, this idea that you're sort of walking the middle ground between political poles. And you have this figure who's so polarizing that it really makes it difficult to find that middle ground. And I would say that, you know, it also provides us an opportunity to potentially forge a new path ahead. Objectivity has always been the ideal. It's something that we can't actually attain. So I think now we're seeing journalists and people who are, you know, leading media organizations increasingly look toward sort of how they can be fair toward their audience, upfront toward their audience, and establish some semblance of public trust in many cases that has atrophied.
So you also mentioned criticism, I guess, about news and news publications. And we see some interesting things, I think, often in satirical contexts. But what about, how do you go about handling that, I guess, in a reporting style or context?
I mean, criticism is an interesting beast. You have to consume a lot of media and sort of have internally sort of very clear North Stars of what journalism should be. So me at our publication, we have a certain set of objectives we'd like journalism to accomplish, best practices and whatnot. So I think, you know, what's emerged since the election in the United States is a lot of introspection from the American media in particular. So you do have some reception among mainstream journalists to sort of reevaluate their role and to sort of look at stories that they've covered or, you know, longer trends of coverage and whether or not that's good, whether they're falling into traps of, you know, both sidesism or sort of adhering to neutrality when they should have a harder edge.
Is unbiased journalism a thing?
I mean, it's an ideal. I don't think it actually exists. I think objectivity is sort of like this internal mythology that we've really been using for decades. And in a previous era of mass media where you're trying to sort of shoot for the middle, the majority of people who are basically centrist one way or another, now with so much choice within the media market, I don't think that you could build a viable model strictly off of, you know, down the road journalism. Even if you have publications such as the Washington Post and the New York Times, they sort of sell themselves as, you know, neutral arbiters of truth. But in reality, what they are selling to their audience is a particular worldview and a particular, you know, set of ideals that they hold as an institution.
And that's okay?
Yeah, I think that's perfectly fine. Yeah, I think the important thing from my perspective is that publications and individual journalists are upfront about their own personal perspective, their own biases. So I think we're sort of at this historical inflection point. We're moving away from this sort of notion of objectivity, more in the direction of journalists saying, hey, this is where I'm coming from. This is the evidence. I'm going to lay it out for you. But also, this is my conclusion.
That's quite different from, I think, where, or at least how we portrayed journalism or how journalism was portrayed in the past. Why do you think that is? What's causing this change? Does that seem to be the trend?
I mean, I think it's mostly a socioeconomic change. You have obviously huge, huge trends within consumption habits. People are moving from print media toward digital media. They're moving from linear TV toward more on-demand video. And I think there's so much choice within the market that people are naturally going to gravitate with things with which they identify, whether that's a political affiliation or whether that's sort of their personal identities or a cultural affiliation. So I think we're at an interesting spot right now where there are opportunities to build business models by cultivating sort of a targeted, focused audience that all share a set of community ideals. And we're seeing some interesting experimentation in that regard. Obviously, legacy news organizations can't necessarily do that because they've sort of established a brand on a certain set of principles. So it's an interesting sort of terrain to navigate.
I'd love to hear your feedback on that, Nikolai. So how does PressReader not necessarily control, but how does PressReader's role fit into that sort of equation? And do you notice, I guess, from your perspective, that a lot of these, I guess you could say, a lot of journalism is somewhat becoming opinion pieces with arguments for and kind of showing the facts as being presented and the conclusions that they're coming to?
I think an important, the operative word in the question that you just asked is the facts, mm-hmm. right? I completely agree. I mean, it's perfectly fine for media organization to adhere to a certain bias. I mean, look at us as individuals. We tend to gravitate to people that we want to associate with, that we share some common ideas, some interests, some beliefs, and that's perfectly fine. However, our friendship would be based on a certain set of values. To me, a fact is that unchangeable, unwavering value that exists in the journalism as a profession. Mm-hmm. So as long as there is an interpretation and an opinion analysis that is, you know, initially declared as this is the bias that we're taking, or you just know that that organization is taking a specific leaning, that's perfectly fine. And really, because of our interests as humans, that's the only way for organizations to sustain and gain the interest. Nobody's interested in neutrality anymore. Mm. Going back to the other part of your question, the focus for us has been to acquire rights to as much content as we could to be able to cover the widest spectrum as possible in terms of the readership. You have to provide the content and quality content, content that perhaps call it our vetting process, content that we believe brings value to the readers, but content that we're not vetting in terms of the political leanings or socioeconomic leanings. No, it's the content that is of interest to our readers. And it's the content that drives the consumption based on those interests. So, you will still inevitably be sitting in your mini echo chamber on PressReader by virtue of the content that you consume. But we are going to expose you to content with different perspectives. That is done algorithmically. When you come to PressReader, you tell us what your interests are. You decide that you want to consume content on, say, sports, politics, Brexit, you know, BC elections, whatever. You select those topics, but those topics are semantically driven from the content that we process. You don't tell us that you're focusing on BC elections and you're an NDP supporter. No, we will show you everything about BC elections. Now, naturally, the more content that you're going to consume about that is in support of your political affiliations, you will see that content because you will also engage with readers who are in that same, you know, chamber.
So this sounds to me like you're saying there is a deliberate and a conscious effort to ensure that for PressReader's subscribers, if there are topics that I'm interested in, then my feed is not just full of the particular bias that I might subscribe to, but rather tries at least to show equal amounts or some amounts of both sides, and then it's up to the user to decide what to actually read.
Absolutely. No, that's absolutely true. And on top of it, there are a number of other features that are in the product that kind of drag you, put the user into the engagement cycle with other readers. That engagement cycle will inevitably lead to some sort of a debate on the issue.
A bit of a philosophical question, I suppose. How important is that, even leading into that debate? And then is there some part that might think that it might be comforting to think that, yes, we're providing both sides, but is that enough?
Oh, that's a deep one. We have a few kind of internal mantras by which we go. One is that it's just the beginning. The other one, it's never enough. So I think if I were to be sitting here and tell you that it's enough, I'd be lying, or I'd be foolish to think that it is. The revolution that we have gone through in the past two decades have allowed us as individuals an unprecedented access to information. Something that we couldn't have fathomed how much of that information is as before. And that's really what's fueling the progress for us as a society. So there's never going to be enough. Think of Google. What does Google stand for? What is the name? It's a number. It's 10 to 100th degrees. But ultimately it's the infinity. And that's what it is. The content is infinite. And more content is going to be produced, which creates another set of difficulties for new media organizations that are trying to enter this space. Is how do you make yourself stand out of the crowd? How do you build the trust with the readers?
So currently, it seems that, if I understand correctly, which I probably don't, that Google's sort of trying to cater to users who are looking for information and rewarding sites on their SEO and having better SERPs based on users are satisfied with the information or users being satisfied with the information that they find by not bouncing. Now, it also does an interesting thing, which is it lets people know that these are advertisements versus these are not. But again, is that enough? Now, Dave, I'd like to actually ask you kind of the same question, but maybe phrased a little bit differently. In journalism, then understanding that we have our biases when we're reporting things and potentially overcompensating by pointing out the other sides that could be there, is that enough? And we can often feel safe maybe that we've done so, but is that not also pointing or creating a bias in another direction, or at least only a two-sided story potentially?
Right. I mean, I think it's an interesting case study has come during the presidential campaign in the United States and immediately thereafter. It's almost become a meme within the American media community of sort of sending reporters out to the middle of the country to talk to the mythic Trump voter who is sort of a hard on his luck Democrat who used to work in the factories. NAFTA sort of screwed him out of his job in the 1990s. And there's been story upon story sort of laying out these individuals, and they're all true stories. But it does sort of accentuate a certain segment of the population, to the detriment of other segments of the population. So I do think there can be overcompensation in one way or another to charges of bias. So I think journalists, it's very important for them to be self-aware about sort of what their motivating, sort of like their motivating ideals are and how to actually go about that in a very straight line.
So for sure, we've mentioned fact as being important, but when we consider perspective in conjunction with fact, we can also often see that there are many sides to stories, I think. Something that Wikipedia, I think, has done a very interesting job, at least, of doing is opening up who is responsible for curating fact. And that sort of tries to give a lot of perspective or ability to have perspective. And oftentimes you find in the discussion page a lot of interesting things going on. I was really surprised, I think, in looking into some computer science or linguistics books and going into the discussion behind things on Wikipedia to find the authors sometimes having these discussions there. Mm-hmm. They're people who are definitely care about these topics very deeply. Sure, sometimes there's misinformation. Do you see this sort of a model, kind of a decentralized model for contributing to information as being something more that we're going toward?
I mean, I think we're there already. If you spend time on Twitter or Facebook or whatnot, that was sort of the idea of the internet, or one of the ideas of the early internet, is that you will have a democratized information environment. But I think you will always need journalists, people who are dedicated to sort of cutting through that noise. There's so much information that's overloading us from every direction now that I think it behooves us as a society to support people who really think about these questions in a very critical way.
Almost like electing somebody to do research for us.
Yeah, certainly.
Look at the printed publications in the past. The editor was the curator of that content. That was his job or her job. And as consumers, we paid money to the editor to produce the, you know, the content that we trusted that editor to produce, the content that would be of interest to us. With Wikipedia example, you bring up an interesting point of sort of community engagement in ensuring, I don't want to say fairness, because I think that would be subjective to where you are and how large that community is, but some sort of a...
Maybe creating its own echo chambers?
Maybe so, yes. And that again, that creates another set of problems. But, you know, as part of the hackathon today at TED, you know, we looked at solutions on, as I said, the three challenges that we're trying to address as a group. And there have been a number of solutions that actually focused on community engagement. You know, at the last podcast, we talked about a one-way communication that existed in the past between the journalist, the publisher, and their audience. And obviously that doesn't work today. So how do you engage with your readers beyond simply providing them an ability to comment? But how do you go beyond that? Some really, really clever ideas. We'll feature them actually in the next issue of The Insider on Press Readers. So the ideas that the judges thought were the most relevant, the most applicable, the most sustainable will highlight them.
So how do things like trusted news sources versus false news kind of play into all of this?
Well, just for some background, trust in media, public trust in media, is an all-time low, depending on what sort of poll you look at. But trust in particular media institutions remains high. So I do think that while people in the United States at least distrust, quote unquote, the media, there is some, you know, identification with certain outlets, which I think is important, and those outlets need to maintain. I think one of the downsides of sort of this broader trend that we are talking about now of sort of democratized information, the internet, is that it does allow people who either have ill intentions or just don't have training or don't sort of adhere to journalistic principles, put information out on the internet very easily, and that they can travel very wide very quickly. So I think that them having that ability, the benefits certainly outweigh the downsides, but there are downsides. And we see that with things like fake news or just any other sort of misinformation you see online.
Now, is that very different from what we've seen historically?
I don't think it's particularly different, other than the delivery mechanism. I think the fact that we do have these tech platforms that have such large scale, it allows this misinformation to travel farther and wider and faster than anything we've ever seen before.
No, the immediacy of this impact and a virtual inability to counter that impact later on. You know, we talked about being first over being factual, and that was more in with respect to publishers, how they got into, so many have got into this cycle of that they needed to break the news story first without really verifying it. And then they would get into that snowball cycle, propagating the same piece of information, which would later on come up as untrue. And that's an issue. Obviously, there are a number of tech platforms that are trying to address that, you know, with either labeling the story that seems to be not quite factually based. But it is a challenge that we need to address.
Does it matter?
Does it matter for us as a society? Or
does it matter if the publications are factual, are true, and how? So this is maybe I'll give a little more explanation of where and why this question is coming to mind. I was watching a show. Can't think of the name right now, but it was a particularly unhealthy family, and kind of watching this and thinking, you know, my mind is processing this, and is this any different from me going through or experiencing this myself, and now do I have these sort of ideas that this is what a family is like, this is what interactions are like, and how it's affecting me, versus, you know, is this factual, is this true, is this healthy, is this better? So yeah, I guess my question is, does it matter? How does it matter? Why does it matter? And then when we say something's factual, I think it's very interesting that, of course, we want to believe it. We want to believe that this is true, and we want to have the best perspective around it. And I don't know that we can ever know with 100% certainty that that is, not only is that true, but I'm seeing it from a perspective that is the only perspective, or the most true, the truest perspective, or from all perspectives that encompass all truth for everyone forever, or have that meaning. So whatever we have at best, I guess, is a subset of possible truths around the fact and perspectives to have. That's way off into philosophical land.
It is, but you know, they say ignorance is bliss, yes, right? So if, and I guess, I mean, maybe it's a slightly naive way of thinking, but I would think that for us to be a progressive society, we need to be an educated society. Mm. And you can only become an educated society if you are exposed to facts based on which you can draw your own conclusions, should you choose to.
Right.
Now, you can artificially limit the number of facts that you're exposed to, either yourself or by virtue of some sort of control, but that's not a society that we strive to be, I don't think. I have difficulty imagining a society that lives without access to facts. Well, maybe I shouldn't have difficulty. Look at some countries that live in that realm. Mm-hmm.
Last time you were on the show, I think we talked a little bit about fact and how when you start to add complexity to it, it becomes very difficult to prove. And I think we said, you know, there are 10 people. It's relatively easy to prove. You could have a camera. Maybe you could have multiple camera points and kind of show
the context.
Right? Yeah, right. But then when you say something like they are together, what does that mean? And, you know, are we now showing intent? They're protesting against something. And so those kinds of things start to become more and more difficult to sort of prove without having further background knowledge and things like that. But I think often, and maybe I'm wrong here, but oftentimes when we are showing fact, it is leading to opinion. And I think now maybe we're more open about that and saying we have a conclusion as journalists, we're trying to lead somewhere. Is that the case, or am I missing that? Is that a good thing? And then how factual do or should we be?
I mean, I think that's certainly true. If you were to look at newspapers or news programs from 50 years ago, they would have a much more sort of standard who, what, where, why approach to news. Now, just given the fact that we can get so much information about breaking news events instantaneously online, journalists have to add value through their analysis. So now if you look at the newspaper, it's not who, what, where, when, why. It's so what. Why should we be caring about this? So there's a more analytical perspective, and it inherently opens sort of the reader to the journalist perspective, and then the journalist in turn to the reader's criticism of that perspective, which is a big sort of social change, I think, that we're still trying to figure out. I think it's definitely good that we're moving in that direction, but it's a question also of how journalists frame that, how they present that to the audience, saying that, hey, this is my bias up front, this is where I'm coming from, and this is how I got to my conclusion. I feel like right now we're sort of in the center of the center of these two different eras in that respect, and we don't really know quite how to deal with that. But I'd say to your broader question about why it matters, whether it's true, if you look at the American election, Donald Trump told a very good story. He said basically the system was rigged, and there's inherent large truths to that. But if you were to actually look at the facts of whether he had a plan for that, whether that he was the right guy to tackle that question, there's a million other facts that point to the notion that he's not the right person to sort of pursue that perceived mission. So I think, you know, in the American election, at least, we had a situation where a better story sort of overcame facts and a lot of the public decision making, which I would argue led to a bad political outcome.
he not only managed to tell the story, but managed to tell the story in the most effective way. And that is going straight to the people that he's trying to reach. And go with a message that was perhaps so far out of line, so far out of the norm, you know, the proverbial norm, that it would get the extra coverage on the mainstream media as something that was, ooh, he said this or he said that. And that continuous spin of the stories that were planted through these direct-to-consumer channels like Twitter, that's why he had the coverage that he did.
It's a very interesting point, I think, that you're making when you say directly to the end reader or the end sort of consumer. And so historically, journalism, news media, publications have acted a lot as filters for information, whereas now there are a lot of direct lines. So I guess that does ask the question, or maybe begs the question, do we need these filters? And should we, as people, actually take more responsibility, I guess we do, with our what we choose to read and whatnot, but should we be actively seeking these filters?
I mean, I think generally speaking, news literacy is horrendously low, and that's something that we need as a society to address. I also think that news consumers need to take responsibility for sort of filtering their own information diets, so it's a little bit healthier than it currently is. But I also think from a journalistic perspective that the role is changing a little bit. We're not sort of speaking from on high to our audience. There's a good argument to be made now that just given the amount people are able to participate online, that journalists should sort of slide into the role of discussion leader as much as they are sort of this arbiter of truth, which I think can be a very constructive thing. In our discussion this morning, for example, we had a lot of sort of back and forth with people that were not in the industry, which I think moved all of us collectively ahead. I heard things that I'd never heard before. People in the audience heard things that they had never heard before from within the industry. So I think having that role of, you know, leading discussion and sort of trying to proactively seek out engagement from people is more in the direction that we're moving now.
Now, you're saying leader, but I'm for some reason kind of reading between the lines and hearing facilitator. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a fair characterization. I think the, you know, when I say leader or facilitator, I mean, you need a person who, you know, spends time thinking about exactly how to structure this, how to do this in the best way to have the most constructive outcome. Obviously, there are, you know, you can sort of differ in the details of how to approach that. But I do think that it's helpful to have someone who has some semblance of expertise or some previous knowledge that will help sort of guide the discussion in the right direction.
How has the sort of the new format of technology and life and media, how has this changed the interaction between media journalists and the public?
I mean, there's a lot more instantaneous feedback, for better and for worse. So me, for example, I get a lot of really great reader email just based on what I've written. People email me back, and I tend to try to publish those things when I can, just have a reader roundup, because I like to have that sort of give and take. On the other hand, and you saw this a lot over the last year or so, there is a lot of sort of, you know, targeted harassment toward journalists who write things that displease people, which is a huge thing that we need to address. And that obviously extends far beyond journalism too. I mean, everyone has had interactions with trolls online, and there's a big sort of troll culture, and we don't really know quite how to handle that. But I do think for journalists, particularly female journalists, particularly Jewish female journalists, they do face a lot of that online, and it's really frightening in some cases.
I don't know if there's anything to add. I mean, this is spot on. I mean, we did talk about that the sort of monologue era of journalism has ended. So it does give these opportunities to engage with readers, should you choose to engage with them. And that's a big should, because not everybody does choose to do that. And I think as a media organization, you need to ask yourself a question. What do you want to get out of this engagement? And what is your mission in terms of reaching these readers, these consumers of the content that you create? Do you care about the readers? Because if you do, then I'd say that the engagement is the only way forward. If you don't, if your position is still from the dark ages that I'll produce the content, you do whatever you want, then, you know, there is an expiry date on that model. The type of engagement, and I think the facilitator characterization is an interesting one, because I always thought that as journalists, we also have a higher mission in the society. We educate the society. Civility in communication is one of those, you know, elements that forms part of that education. And, you know, we're still perhaps not at the infancy stage of sort of training the general public to use what resources are available, you know, on the web today. But there is that human nature feeling that, oh, well, since I'm doing from my phone or from my home computer, nobody will know who I am. So maybe this is what we need to talk about. Guess what? Everything that you do is known to everyone who needs to know. To the level of your IP address, to your demographic data, and there is a lot that can be done with it. So it's almost like you expose that side and say, what you say does matter. Not in a way that will stifle the conversation or it will impede the freedom of expression in any way, but to bring back to, you know, because you wouldn't necessarily say these things face to face, but people have a very different perspective of when they're sitting on the other side of the screen.
There's so many more topics I'd love to explore. You know, trolls, what is a troll? Of course, we all know, but what's the importance of trolls and does it exist? A lot of interesting things, but I think we're going to get ready to wrap up. And I'd just love to ask a little bit about how to reach out to both of you. So, Nikolai, how do our listeners reach out to you if they'd like to?
A couple of ways. First of all, they can obviously go to pressreader.com. My Twitter handle is my last name, MALYAROB. We're at this very interesting intersection between readers, publishers, and brands that we work with. So the feedback that we'd love to hear is from everyone, not just the consumers, not just the journalists, because it is a dialogue, and it actually goes in all these different directions. Mm-hmm. But pressreader.com is probably be the best way to reach me.
Okay, great. And Dave?
You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is just David Uberti, UBERTI. I also host a weekly podcast called The Kicker, which we discuss some of the similar topics as we discuss here today, journalism and media primarily. And then finally, you know, our website, cjr.org, we have, you know, this ongoing conversation about what journalism should be. And we're certainly not there yet. But I think if we keep it real and we, you know, keep the machines running, then I think we can get there.
Very cool. Well, thank you both very much for being on this episode of the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Check out our website, vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Rate and subscribe on iTunes. Much appreciated.
You can follow us on Twitter, VanTechPodcast.
Feel free to leave some comments below.
You can also hit us up on the YVR Dev, the Vancouver Tech, the Van Tech Slacks. I'm at James.
And I'm at Drew. Special thanks to Same Room for hooking us up with an integration that allows us to have a cross-team Slack channel, VanDevs.
Do you have a meetup that you want us to plug? Email us, show@vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Music by A Shell in the Pit from the game Parkitect. See you at one of the meetups
around town.